returned from Chesterton, her spirit crushed, ready to be part of the family again, and they let her. They actually let her. With a kindness utterly unlike anything she recognized in herself, they took her back, even though she could not have deserved it less. The wreck of the good ship, Julia, out of Brooklyn, carrying the precious cargo of their love, was ready to be hauled off the reef of life and salvaged and refloated, and they did it. They took her back without a word of reproach. Now it was Julia's turn to grieve, and they let her, which was another gift. She mourned her lost life, and she mourned the death of the magician she would never be. She buried that mighty sorceress with full honors, and with the grief, unbidden, came its ghostly golden cousin, relief. She had been trying so hard, for so long, to be something the world did not want her to be. Now she could finally stop. The world had won. She yielded to her family's embraces, and she was grateful for them. What was so great about magic, anyway, compared to love? Seriously, what? Oh, the timorous overtures of her sister, the humanist. By now she was a senior in high school herself. As she labored over her college applications, Julia reactivated her own. They worked on them together, side by side at the kitchen table, swapping tips, her sister coaching her on her essay, Julia dragging her sister through basic calculus by main force. They were a team again, the two of them. Julia had forgotten what it felt like to be part of a family. She'd forgotten how good it could feel, and how much she needed it. Of Julia's legendary 7 acceptances, only Stanford's could be salvaged, but that was enough. There was a gap or 3 in her resume, sure, but if you cocked your head and blurred your eyes, you could take her magical research for some sort of worthy independent ethnographic project. So it was sunny California for her. Just what she needed. Fun in the sun. Put some color in her cheeks. She'd spend a year saving up cash and matriculate in the fall. It was all arranged. Because Julia had given up, she was packing it in. She washed her hands of the realms invisible that had so thoroughly washed their hands of her. She would take a page from the holy book of those child-raping utopian socialists she'd written about for Mr. Karras. When your sacred intentional community collapses, it's time to suck it up and sell silverware instead. Julia would take a page from Jack Dunn. At the end of the poem, hadn't he run to the goat, by which he meant the constellation Capricorn, a footnote gallantly informed her, to find new love? Or was it lust? Or maybe it turned out it was too late for him. Maybe that was somebody else. That poem was pretty fucking unintelligible. Anyway, it had a happy ending. Ish. Still, she had her bad days, no question, when the black dog of depression sniffed her out and settled its crushing weight on her chest and breathed its pungent dog breath in her face. On those days she called in sick to the IT shop where, most days, she untangled tangled networks for a song. On those days she pulled down the shades and ran dark for 12 or 24 or 72 hours, however long it took for the black dog to go on home to its dark master. She couldn't go back. She knew that now. The magic kingdom was closed to her. But some days she couldn't see a way forward either. She always righted herself in the end, with the help of a dandy, cat-eyed new shrink, a woman this time, and her dandy 450 milligrams of Wellbutrin and 30 milligrams of Lexapro daily, and her dandy new online support group for the depressed. Actually, the support group really was pretty dandy. It was something special. It was founded by a woman who'd worked successively at Apple, and then Microsoft, and then Google. She blazed a glittering arc in the firmament at each firm for about 4 or 5 years, piling up tranches of stock options, before she rolled neurochemical snake eyes and a bout of clinical depression knocked her out of the sky. By the time Google was done with her, she was 44 and had her fuck-you money in the bank, so she retired early and started Free Trader Beowulf instead. Free Trader Beowulf, you had to be at least 40 and a recovering pen-and-paper role-playing gamer to get the reference, but it was apt. Google it. FTB was an online support group for depressed people, but not your common run of depressed person. Oh, no. To get in the door, you first had to show them your prescriptions. They wanted credentials, solid ones. A bunch of nerds like this, they didn't want to hear your whining, and they didn't want to read your poems, sorry, Jack, or look at your doomy watercolors. This crowd wasn't soft core. If you were depressed, they wanted to see the hard stuff, a diagnosis from an actual psychiatrist, and hardcore chemical-on-neuron action. And if you were rocking double neurochemical penetration, like Julia was, all the better. If that all worked out, then they sent you a video invitation. It was meaningless in itself, a red herring, just a bunch of new-agey platitudes, delivered by a sympathetic hippie-type actor. But buried in it, for those who thought to look, was a clue. A single frame of what looked like white noise, but which turned out to be hard data. The black-and-white pixels stood for ones and zeros that, when laid end-to-end, formed a sound file. The audio was of somebody speaking the phone number of an old-school dial-up BBS, which, when you called it up, frog-marched you through a pretty chunky series of pure math problems, which, if you solved them in 6 hours or less, yielded a sequence of numbers that turned out to be ULAM numbers, ULAM being the password to the website at the IP address they gave you if you beat the test, where there was a flash game that made absolutely no sense unless you could think in four spatial dimensions, but if you could, you got a pair of GPS coordinates in South Dakota that turned out to be a geocaching site from which you could recover a grotesquely complicated three-dimensional wooden puzzle inside of which was, etc., etc., etc. All good, clean, all-American fun. A childless, clinically depressed 44-year-old retiree with a genius IQ and an eight-figure bank account had nothing if not time on her hands. It was obnoxious, but nobody was twisting Julia's arm, and she had time on her hands, too, as it happened. It took Julia 3 weeks to work her way through the intellectual obstacle course. She would have liked to see Quentin try it. But at the end of it all, she recovered on the strength of many quarters, a plastic bubble from the claw machine in a neglected video arcade on the Jersey Shore. The bubble contained a flash drive. The flash drive contained the real invitation. No tricks this time. She was in. Free Trader Beowulf had 14 members, and Julia made it 15. It was only a message board, but it felt more like home than anything had since the 2 hours Julia had spent at Breakbills 4 years earlier. The people in FTB got her. She didn't have to explain herself. They understood her gallows humor and her Gödel, Escher, Bach references, her sudden rages and her long silences. She picked up their arcane in-jokes and running gags pretty quickly. Her whole life she'd felt like the last living member of a lost Amazonian tribe, speaking her own extinct dialect. But here, finally, was her ethnic group. They were a bunch of depressed, overeducated shut-ins, but they seemed human to her. Or maybe not human, but whatever Julia was, they were, too. References to real life were tacitly discouraged on FTB. You didn't use real names. In most cases, she had only the vaguest sense of where the other members lived, or what they did for a living, whether they were married, or in a few cases, even what gender they were. As far as Julia knew, they never met in person. FTB just wasn't a meet space thing. Outing another member's real-world identity was an offense punishable by expulsion, or it would have been if it ever happened, but it never did. Welcome to Faceless Book, and Antisocial Network. That spring was the happiest time Julia had lived through since her old life ended. She chattered away to the free traders all day, every day. They hung around her in an invisible crowd, bantering and kibitzing on her work projects. She typed while she ate her breakfast. She typed walking down the street. The last thing she saw before she fell asleep was the free trader app on her smartphone on the pillow next to her, and it was the first thing she saw when she opened her eyes in the morning. She opened herself up to them in a way she never had to anyone. No irony, no caveats, no regrets. She poured out her broken heart to the free traders, and they took it and cleaned it up and fixed it up and gave it back to her fresh and bloody and pumping again. She never said a thing about break bills. That would have been beyond the pale, even for FTB. But she found to her relief that she didn't really have to. Whatever was wrong, the details didn't matter. It was enough for them to know that there was an enormous piece missing from her world, and they understood what that felt like because they were missing pieces, too. Didn't matter what shape it was. Julia wouldn't have been surprised to learn that there were a few break bills also ran among the free traders, but she never asked. She had warm feelings for all the free traders, but inevitably there were a few with whom she formed tighter bonds, a little clique, a circle within the circle, comprising herself and three others. Failstaff, a gentle poster whose cultural references put him 3 or 4 decades older than Julia, Pouncy Silver Kitten, whose acid sarcasm was extreme even for FTB, but who chose his targets humanely, mostly, and Asmodeus, who understood Julia's feelings with telepathic completeness, and whose facility with theoretical physics was so extraordinary she seemed to be posting from somewhere off-planet. Julia posted as Vicious Circe. They'd been a trio before she came along, but they were happy to accept her as one of them and to make their never-ending conversations four-handed. It was acceptable on FTB to take a thread private, if all parties agreed, and once in a while she and Asmo and Pouncy and Failstaff would recede into their own highly abstract world together. In those private threads, they would get a little more concrete about their personal lives, though it was still considered gauche to drop any geospecific details. That became part of the game, keeping their identities obscure, and another part of the game was constructing elaborate fictional biographies and resumes for each other. Julia did an FBI serial killer profile for each of the other three, complete with police sketches. Another game they were fond of was called Series. It was simple. Somebody would provide 3 words, or 3 numbers, or names, or molecules, or shapes, or whatever. Those were the first 3 terms in the series. Then you had to figure out what the next term in the series was, and what principle generated it. You wanted to make your series maximally difficult, but still theoretically solvable, while also making sure there was only one possible solution, i.e., only one guiding principle that could be extrapolated from the 3 examples. Once the solution was cracked, second prize went to the first person who could iterate the series 10 times. FTB took over her life, and she let it. Sometimes, even when she was offline, it was as if FTB was running by itself in her head. Her brain had spent so much time with these invisible personalities that they'd calved off little clones of themselves in her brain, pirate software versions of Asmo and Pouncy and Failstaff and all the others that ran on Julia's hardware. She wasn't demented. She wasn't. It was just a game she played with herself. It was a little insane, but hey, whatever got you through, right? And everything else was going fine. She'd gained weight, stopped scratching herself, barely even bit her cuticles anymore. She hadn't done the rainbow spell in ages. She knew she was obsessed, but it was turning out that she was the kind of person who needed to be obsessed with something, and she could have done a lot worse. God knows she had before. She figured, let the fever run its course. It would break, and the patient would wake up clammy but clear-headed, and the fever dreams would fade. She'd head off to Stanford in the fall, get a new life, get some real-world, visible, analog friends, wipe the slate clean. But first, she'd give it its head, let it run a little. Which is how Julia found herself late on a weekend afternoon in March, wandering through Prospect Heights toward Bed-Stuy. She'd become a prodigious walker of late, because she needed some kind of exercise, and exposure to sunlight improved her mood. And she could take the free traders with her, not only in their capacity as spectral presences in her brain, but as actual presences on her smartphone, for which Failstaff had ginned up a clever little app. No iPhones, Natch, Android only. The free traders were huge open-source snobs. She strode the earth, clad in the invisible armor of their virtual companionship. Julia typed as she walked. She had developed a great facility in doing this, using her peripheral vision to weave around fire hydrants and dog shit landmines and other pedestrians. A key part of successfully being Julia, it seemed, was not giving a shit if you looked weird. Today she half-listened via the app's text-to-speech feature, while Pouncey and Asmodeus went back and forth on the validity of Hofstadter's strange loop theory of consciousness as derived from Gödel numbers, or something like that. The other half of her consciousness, Hofstadterian or no, was deployed in looking at the front doors of the houses she passed. Specifically, she was looking at the way they were divided up into square and rectangular panels of different sizes. Most of them were, anyway. This was not, on the face of it, an overwhelmingly interesting activity. In fact, she would have been hard-pressed to explain to anybody exactly why she was doing it. It was just that the doors had begun to remind her of a game of series they'd played the other day. Pouncey had offered up a geometrical puzzle, painstakingly executed in ASCII characters, consisting of simple patterns of squares on a small grid. It had turned out, Failstaff nailed it, that the patterns could be understood as successive states of a very simple cellular automaton, so simple that they could nut out the rules in their heads once they had the general idea, or Failstaff could, anyway. The funny thing was, Julia fancied that as she walked, she could spot sequences from the series in the different configurations of the doors she was passing. It seemed like if she kept going long enough, she could always find the next term. It was just a goofy mental exercise. Sometimes the pattern was in wood, sometimes in glass, or a wrought iron gate. Once it was in cinder blocks, in a blocked-up window, which was cheating, but it was weird how often she found it. She started setting rules for herself. She would stop walking if it took her more than a block to find the next term in the series. Then it had to be within a block and on the same side of the street, and so on. But the right pattern always turned up just in time. She wasn't sure if this was a significant discovery or not, but she felt a compulsion to see how long she could keep it going. She could imagine the acidity of the sarcasm Pouncey would slather all over her if she told the others what she was doing. It would be seriously corrosive. pH-0 sarcasm. It was all working out very neatly, though. The only difference between her and Pouncey's cellular automata was that hers was running backward. The rules were being applied in reverse, so it was winding back down to its initial state. That was another reason she kept walking. The series was finite. It would be over soon, whatever happened. Once she got lost for a block, but then she realized she'd munged the transformation, and once she fixed it, then, sure enough, there it was. An old wooden door with inset panels, three of them slightly lighter in color to pick out the right configuration. It was a will-o'-the-wisp leading her onward, farther into the perilous marsh of Bed-Stuy, deeper into a dreamlike, hypnagogic state. A small but vigilant sector of Julia's brain wasn't that stoked about how far into Bed-Stuy she was getting. Row houses were giving way to vacant lots and chop shops and half-built apartment houses that the recession had killed off before they were finished. She had about an hour before dark, and it was no longer possible to tell herself that some of the houses were boarded up because they were undergoing very ambitious gut renovations, because those houses weren't being renovated. They were crack houses. But it wouldn't be long before she found the door that corresponded to Pouncey's starting configuration, and then the series would be at an end, which is to say, at its beginning, and she could turn around and head back to Park Slope. And sure enough, just past Troop Avenue, there it was. It was not a pretty house, but it wasn't a crack house either. It was a two-story, lime-green, clapboard house with an antique rabbit ears antenna on top and a surly gang of aluminum garbage cans in the cracked cement yard out front. The front door was an 8-paned glass affair. One pane, the top left corner, had been punched out and plastic-wrapped, thereby completing the series. And that was that. It was finished. The sight of that final pattern, the initial state, released Julia from the spell. The dream logic had iterated itself out. She looked around like a sleepwalker awakened, wondering where the hell she was exactly. Somebody was still babbling in her ear in a computer-generated voice about Hofstadter. Exhaustion broke over her in a wave. She must have walked for miles, and the sun was setting. She sat down on the stoop. She needed a ride home. A car service would be expensive, but being mugged and or assaulted would be even more expensive. Plus, she felt like she would literally drop in her tracks if she had to take another step. She killed the FTB app and took out her earbuds, and the voices died away. Silence. Reality. Behind her, she heard the door open. She got up again and held up a hand. Okay, okay, she was going. She didn't suppose that a lecture on cellular automata would really pass for an excuse for trespassing with the residents of some random lime-green shitbox house on Troop Avenue. But the guy in the door wasn't shooing her away. He was a white guy, owlish-looking, maybe 30, in a vintage blazer and jeans, and an insta-annoying pork-pie hat. He just looked at her, assessing. Behind him she could see other people in the house, sitting and standing, chatting and moping and doing things with their hands. Only they didn't have anything in their hands. A weird, acid-green light flared for a second in the doorway, from somewhere she couldn't see, like there was welding going on in there. Somebody gave an ironic cheer. The air absolutely reeked of magic. You could barely breathe, it was so thick. Julia squatted down on her haunches on the sidewalk like a toddler and put her head in her hands and laughed and cried at the same time. She felt like she was going to pass out or throw up or go insane. She had tried to walk away from the disaster, to run away from it. She really, truly had. She'd broken her staff and drowned her book and sworn off magic forever. She'd moved on and left no forwarding address. But it hadn't been enough. Magic had come looking for her. She hadn't run far enough or fast enough or hid herself well enough, and the disaster had tracked her down, and it had found her. It wasn't going to let her go. It was about to start all over again. Chapter 16. During everything that followed, all the time while he nearly got creamed by a vaporetto as he swam to shore, while he dragged himself up some ancient stone steps out of the water, the Grand Canal was well appointed with means of egress for those who fell or flung themselves into it, and trudged back to Josh's palazzo alone, Josh having had his hands full keeping Poppy out of the clutches of the carabinieri, who showed up shortly after Quentin went under. Quentin's mind was on fire with the only piece of useful information the dragon had given him, that there was still a way back to Fillory. They weren't going to get the button, but he could let go of that now because there was a way back, if they could just figure out what the dragon meant. He thought about it while he rinsed off salt and oil and heavy metal particles and worse in a half-hour shower at high temperature and high pressure, and washed his hair three times and dried off and finally tossed his ruined clothes, his beloved Fillorian clothes, his royal clothes, into the trash and crawled into bed. The first door, the dragon had said. The first door. The first door. What did it mean? Of course, there were other words in there to think about. There was a lot to take away from that brief conversation. The old gods were returning. Something about being a hero. All definitely important. Of paramount importance. But the first door, that was the action item. He had the scent. He was going to do it. He was going to follow the clues and get them out of here and back where they belonged. He was going to be a hero, damn it all, whatever the dragon said. He would lose whatever he had to lose, if that's what it took to win. Poppy woke him up the next morning at 7. It was like Christmas morning for her. She was just so excited, and she'd waited as long as she could. She wasn't even jealous. She'd already had 3 cappuccinos, and she'd brought him one. Australians. He thought she was going to start bouncing on his bed. They all worked through the possibilities together over breakfast. "The first door," Josh said. "So it's some primal, like, door, like Stonehenge."
"Stonehenge is a calendar," Poppy said. "It's not a door."
In the course of general orientation, Poppy had almost incidentally been brought up to speed on the existence of fillery. Irritatingly, she took it in stride, the way she did everything else. She was interested in it from an intellectual point of view. She assimilated the information, but it didn't set her imagination burning the way it had Quentin's.
"Maybe it's like a time lock, like on a vault."
"Dude," Quentin said, "forget Stonehenge. It must be something in Venice, like a sea gate or something."
"Venice is a port. That's a kind of door, a portal. The whole city is a door."
"Yeah, but the first?"
"Or it's a metaphorical door," Poppy said. "The Bible or something, like in Dan Brown."
"You know, I bet it's something about the pyramids," Josh said.
"It means the Chatwin's house," Julia said. The conversation stopped.
"What do you mean?"
Poppy said. "Their aunt's house in Cornwall, where they discovered fillery. That was the first door."
It was nice to see Poppy beaten to the punch for once.
"But how do you know?"
Poppy asked.
"I know," Julia said.
Quentin hoped that she wouldn't say what she was about to say next, but she said it anyway.
"I can feel it."
"What do you mean, feel it?"
Poppy said.
"Why do you care?" Julia said.
"Because I'm curious."
Quentin intervened. Julia seemed to have taken an instinctive, prickly dislike to Poppy.
"It makes sense. What's the first way people got into fillery? Through the Chatwin's house. The clock in the back hall."
"I don't know," Josh said. He rubbed his round, stubbly chin.
"I thought you could never get in the same way twice. And anyway, Martin Chatwin was a little kid. That's fine for him, but no way I could fit through the door of a grandfather clock. Not even you could."
"All right," Quentin said. "Sure, but..."
"Plus it was supposed to be a personal invitation, specific to the Chatwins," Josh went on. "Like, those particular kids were particularly awesome in some way, so Ember summoned them so they could use their awesome personal qualities to fix shit in fillery."
"We have awesome personal qualities," Quentin said. "I think we should go. It's our best lead."
"I am going," Julia said.
"Road trip,"
Josh said, turning on a dime.
"All right."
It felt good to be making decisions anyway, whatever they were based on. It felt good to get moving again.
"We'll go tomorrow morning, unless anybody has a better idea before then."
It was getting increasingly hard to not notice that Poppy was helpless with laughter.
"Oh, I'm sorry," she said. "I really am. It's just that, I mean, I know it's real, or I mean, I guess it's real, but do you realize that this is a kid's thing? Fillery? It's like you're worried about how to get to Candyland. Or, I don't know, Smurf Town."
Julia got up and left. She didn't even bother to get annoyed. She took fillery seriously, and she had no patience for and no interest in anyone who didn't. He hadn't noticed till now,
but Julia could be pretty unpleasant when she wanted to be.
"You think Candyland is real?" Josh said. "'Cause I would ditch Fillory in a red-hot minute for that shit. Chocolate swamp and all? And have you seen Princess Frostine?"
"Maybe it's not real to you," Quentin said a little stiffly. "It's just that it's very real to us. Or to me, anyway. It's where I live. It's my home."
"I know, oh no. I'm sorry. I really am."
Poppy wiped her eyes.
"I'm sorry. Maybe you just have to see it."
"Maybe you do. But," Quentin thought, "you probably never will." The next day, they all went to Cornwall. That's where the Chatwin's house was. The house where, in 1917, the Chatwin children went to stay with their Aunt Maud and met Christopher Plover and found their way into Fillory, and the whole magnificent, wretched story began. It was incredible that the house still existed and had been sitting there all this time and that you could just go there. But in a way it was incredible that he hadn't been there already. The Chatwin house wasn't open to the public, but its general whereabouts weren't a secret. It was a matter of historical/Wikipedian record. Nobody had torn it down. It's not like somebody was going to stop them, other than possibly the current owners and the local constabulary. It was about time he went there, if only to pay his respects at what was basically the Trinity test site of the Fillorian mythos. As far as getting there went, Josh swore up and down that he'd been doing serious work with opening portals lately, and he was pretty sure he could get one through to Cornwall. Quentin asked Josh where he thought Cornwall was, then immediately rephrased it and said he would give Josh $100 if he could tell him whether Cornwall was in England, Ireland, or Scotland. Smelling a trick question, Josh went non-linear and guessed Canada. But when Quentin actually showed Josh where it was on a map, way down at the southwestern tip of England, Josh redoubled his swearing, "That shit's practically next door. It's in Europe!" and went into a very technically sophisticated disquisition on lines of magnetic force and astral folding. It really was time Quentin got out of the habit of underestimating him. Poppy said she wanted to come too.
"I've never been to Cornwall," she said. "I've always wanted to meet a native speaker."
"Of English?" Josh said. "Because, you know, I can probably introduce you."
"Of Cornish, Jackass. It's a Brythonic language, meaning it's indigenous to Britain, like Welsh and Breton, and Pictish. Before everything was polluted by the Anglo-Saxons and the Normans, there's tons of power in those old languages. Cornish died out a couple hundred years ago, but there's a big revival happening now. Where are we going exactly?"
They were still sitting around the breakfast table, which over the course of the morning had become the lunch table. Espresso cups and wobbly towers of plates and silverware had been transferred to the floor to make room for a massive atlas Josh retrieved from the library, along with the Fillory books and a biography of Christopher Plover.
"It's called Foy," Quentin said. "It's on the south coast."
"Hmm,"
Poppy said. She put a fingertip on the map.
"We could come in through Penzance. It's a couple of hours' drive from there, tops."
"Penzance?" Josh said. "Like as in the Pirates of? Since when is that a real place?"
"See, okay, I want to say something about this," Poppy said.
She pushed the atlas away and sat back in her chair.
"If I could have the floor for just a moment. Yes, Penzance is a real place. It's a town, it's in Cornwall, and it's real, as in it exists on Earth. You're all so obsessed with other worlds, you're so convinced that this one is crap and everywhere else is great. But you've never bothered to figure out what's going on here. I mean, forget Penzance, Tintagel is real."
"Is that... didn't King Arthur live there?" Quentin said weakly.
"King Arthur lived in Camelot. But he was conceived at Tintagel, supposedly. It's a castle in Cornwall."
"Fuck it," Josh said. "Poppy's right. Let's go there."
It was amazing. Quentin had never met a magician like Poppy. How could someone so utterly literal-minded, so resolutely uninterested in anything beyond mundane reality, work magic?
Yes, but you see, he said, the fact is King Arthur probably wasn't conceived at Tintagel, because he probably didn't exist. Or if he did exist, he was probably some depressing Pictish warlord who was always killing people and breaking them on the wheel and raping their widows. He probably died of the plague at 32. See, that's my problem with this world, if you really want to know. I'm pretty sure that when you say that King Arthur was real, you don't mean King Arthur like in the books. You don't actually mean the good King Arthur. Whereas in Fillory, and feel free to find this hilarious, Poppy, but it's true, there are actual, real kings who aren't bullshit, and I'm one of them. And plus, there are unicorns and pegasi and elves and dwarves and all that. He could have added that some very bad things were real in Fillory that weren't real here, but that wouldn't have strengthened his argument.
There are not elves, Julia said.
Whatever! That's not the point. The point is, I could pretend I don't have a choice and just live here my whole life. I could even go live in Tintagel. But I do have a choice, and I only have one life, and if it's all right with you, I'm going to spend it in Fillory, in my castle, chilling with dwarves and sleeping on Pegasus feathers.
Because it's easier, Poppy said. And why not do the easiest possible thing? Because isn't that always the best thing?
Yes, why not? Why not?
Quentin had absolutely no idea why Poppy aggravated him so much, and so efficiently, with such great precision. And he didn't know why he sounded so much like Benedict right now, either.
All right, already, Josh said. Stop! You live here. You live in Fillory. Everybody's happy.
Sure,
Poppy chirped.
God, Quentin thought, it's like Janet all over again.
They assembled 2 hours later in the narrow street behind the palazzo. The building was too heavily warded to cast a portal inside it.
I thought maybe we could do it down there, Josh peered doubtfully down the street.
There's one of those tiny Venetian micro-alleys down there. Nobody ever uses it. Nobody else had a better suggestion. Quentin felt shifty. It was like they were looking for a place to shoot up or have sex outside. Josh led them 20 yards down the street, which itself wasn't much more than an alley, then cut left into a gap between buildings. There was barely room for 2 people to walk next to each other. At the end of the alley was a bright ribbon of water and sunlight, the Grand Canal. It was deserted, but Josh hadn't been completely right about nobody ever using the alley, because somebody had definitely used it as a urinal not too long ago. It reminded Quentin of when he used to catch a portal back to Breakbills at the end of summer. Usually they'd send him down some random local alley and put the portal at the end. The thought of it ignited a hot coal of nostalgia in his chest for a time when he didn't know better.
Let me see just how much of this I remember.
Josh pulled a crumpled piece of paper out of his pocket, on which he'd scribbled neat columns of coordinates and vectors. Poppy, who was taller than him, kibitzed over his shoulder.
"See, it's not direct," he said, "but there's a junction you can use. It's out in the English Channel somewhere."
"Why don't you go through Belfast?" Poppy said.
"Everybody does. Then you double back south. It's actually shorter in astral geometry."
"Nah, nah," Josh squinted at his writing. "This is way more elegant. You'll see."
"I'm just saying, if you miss the junction and we go in the water, it's a long swim to Guernsey."
Josh stuffed the paper in his back pocket and squared off into his spellcasting stance. He spoke the words quietly and clearly without hurrying. With a lot more confidence than Quentin ever remembered him having, he made a series of symmetrical movements with his arms, shifting his fingers rapidly through different positions. Then he squared his shoulders, bent his knees, and hooked his fingers firmly underhand into the air, like he was preparing to haul open an especially heavy garage door. Sparks flew. Poppy yipped in surprise and stepped back in a hurry. Josh straightened his back and heaved upward. Reality cracked. And the crack slowly widened, revealing behind it something else.
green grass and brighter, whiter sunlight. When the portal was halfway open, Josh stopped and shook out his hands, which smoked. He outlined the top of the doorway with his fingers, then the sides. One side wasn't quite straight, and he accidentally snipped off some of the alley wall. Then he got under it again and pulled and pushed it open the rest of the way. Quentin kept glancing at the mouth of the alley while all this was going on. He heard voices, but nobody walked by. Josh stopped to check his work. Now, in the middle of the bright Venetian afternoon, there stood a rectangle of cooler, somehow higher definition, English noon. Josh bunched his sleeve in his fist and rubbed off a last smudge of Venice.
"All right," he said. "Pretty good?"
His pants were scored with pinhole burns from the sparks. Everyone had to admit it looked pretty good. They stepped through, one by one, gingerly. The bottom of the doorway wasn't quite flush with the pavement, and you could shear off toes on the edge if you weren't careful. But the connection was tight, with no sensation as you went through. It was a totally other level of workmanship, Quentin thought with satisfaction, from the crude portals they'd gone through between the safe houses. They had skipped Penzance after all, as well as Belfast. Josh brought them out in a public park, not far from the center of Foy. This kind of precision over that much distance hadn't been possible even a few years ago, but Google Street View was an absolute boon to the art and craft of creating long-distance portals. Josh went through last and scrubbed it out behind them. Quentin didn't think he'd ever seen anywhere as quintessentially English-looking as Foy. Or maybe he meant Cornish-looking. He wasn't sure what the difference was. Poppy would know. Either way, it was a small town at the mouth of a river that was also called Foy, and Beatrix Potter could have drawn it. The air was cool and fresh after the summer fog of Venice. The streets were narrow and winding and shin-splintingly steep. The sheer volume of floral window boxes overhead almost blocked out the sun. At the little office of tourism in the center of town, they learned that the various Foys were all pronounced Foy, and that even aside from Christopher Plover, the town was something of a hotbed of fictional settings. Manderley from Rebecca was supposed to be nearby, as was Toad Hall from The Wind in the Willows. Plover's house was a few miles out of town. The National Trust owned it now. It was enormous, and some days it was open to tourists. The Chatwin's house was privately owned and not on any tourist maps, but it couldn't be far away. According to legend and all the biographies, it abutted Plover's property directly. They sat on a bench in the thin English sunlight, like clarified butter, while Poppy went off to rent a car. She was the only one of them who carried the full complement of valid IDs and credit cards. When Julia pointed out that she could have stolen one just as easily, Poppy looked at her with wordless horror. She returned in a peppy silver Jag. "Who would have thought you could even get one out here in Smurftown?" she said. They knocked back a pub lunch and set out. It was Quentin's first time in England, and he was amazed. Once they got up the coastal slope and out of town, out into the lumpy, uneven pastures dotted with sheep and stitched together with dense, dark hedges, it looked more like Fillory than he'd thought anywhere on earth could, even more than Venice. Why hadn't anybody told him? Except, of course, they had, and he hadn't believed them. Poppy, in the driver's seat, grinned at him via the rearview mirror as if to say, "See?" Maybe she was right. He hadn't given this world enough credit. Zipping along the narrow highways and shady lanes of rural Cornwall, the four of them could have been regular people, civilians, and would they have been any less happy? Even without magic, they had the grass and that blessed country's solitude, and the sun flickering past between the branches and the solace of an expensive car that somebody else was paying for. What kind of an asshole wouldn't be satisfied with that? For the first time in his life, Quentin seriously considered the idea that he could be happy without Fillory. Not just resigned, but happy. They were certainly as close to Fillory as you could get on Earth. They were closing in on the Chatwin's house. Even the place names sounded Fillorian.
Tuardreath, Castle Doré, lost with Yil. It was as if the green landscape of Fillory was hidden right behind this one, and this was a thin place where the other world showed through. Cornwall was certainly having a good effect on Julia. She was almost lively. She was the only one of them with the gift of not getting carsick while she read, so as they drove, she paged through the Fillory books, applying stickies to certain passages, reading others out loud. She was compiling a list of all the different ways the children had gotten through, a practical traveler's guide to leaving this world behind. In The World in the Walls, Martin gets in through the grandfather clock, and so does Fiona. In the second one, Rupert gets in from his school, so that doesn't help us, and I believe Helen does too, but I can't find it. In The Flying Forest, they get in by climbing a tree. That might be our best bet.
We wouldn't have to break into the house, Quentin said, and we could all fit.
Exactly. And in The Secret Sea, they ride a magic bicycle, so let's keep an eye out for that. Maybe there's a garage or a shed with old things in it.
You realize the fans have probably picked this place clean like years ago, Josh said. We can't be the first people to think of this.
Then in The Wandering Dune, Helen and Jane are painting in a meadow somewhere nearby, which seems like a long shot. But if we have to, we can go back to Foy for art supplies. And that's it.
It's not quite it. Sorry, but nobody one-upped Quentin on Fillory trivia, not even Julia. Martin gets back in The Flying Forest at the end, though Plover doesn't say how he did it. And there's a book you're missing, The Magicians, which is Jane's book about how she went back to Fillory to find Martin. She used the magic buttons to get in, which she found in the well where Helen threw a whole box of them. Jane only used one to get back, so there may be more lying around.
Julia turned around in her seat. How do you know that?
I met her. Jane Chatwin. It was in Fillory. I was getting better from my injuries after we fought Martin, after Alice died.
There was silence in the car, broken by the ticking of the turn signal as Poppy took a fork in the road. Julia studied him with those empty, unreadable eyes.
"Sometimes I forget everything you've been through," she said finally, and turned around to face forward.
It only took them 45 minutes to find Plover's house, a.k.a. Dara's house, which must have once been in deep countryside, but now you could get there on a well-maintained two-lane road. Poppy pulled over on the other side. There was no shoulder, and the jag tilted at a perilous angle. All four of them got out and straggled across the road. There was no traffic. It was about 3:30 in the afternoon. The grounds were surrounded by a formidable stone wall, and a gate framed, with an almost fussy architectural perfection, a view of a palatial Georgian country house set back deep in carefully tended grounds. Dara's house was one of those rectangular English houses made of gray stone that probably conformed to some nutjob 18th-century theory about symmetry and ideal proportions and perfect ratios. Quentin knew Plover had been rich. He'd made one fortune in America already, selling dry goods, whatever they were, before he came to Cornwall and wrote the Fillory novels. But the scale of it was still stunning. It wasn't so much a house as a cliff with windows in it.
"Jeez," Josh said.
"Yeah," said Poppy.
"Hard to imagine somebody living there all by themselves," Quentin said.
"He probably had servants. Was he gay?"
"Dude, totally," Josh said.
There was a sign on the gate, Dara's House, Plover Farm, with a schedule of hours and tours and entrance fees. A blue plaque gave them a capsule biography of Plover. It was a Thursday, and the house was open. A large black bird retched loudly in the underbrush.
"So, are we going in?" Poppy asked.
He thought they would, on the off chance that they might stumble on something, and so they could say they had. But now that they'd arrived, the place felt empty. Nothing here called to Quentin. Plover had never gone to Fillory. All he'd done was write books. The magic was somewhere else.
Nah, he said. I don't think so. Nobody disagreed. They could come back tomorrow, if they were still on Earth.
They trooped back across the road and spread out the map on the hood of the car. The exact location of the house the Chatwins had stayed at near Foy was a matter for speculation, but not wild speculation. There was a limited number of places it could be. Plover's books were full of enchanting descriptions of how the Chatwin kids, singly and en masse, ran and skipped and cycled over from their Aunt Maud's house to visit their beloved Uncle Christopher. Plover had even famously had a little child-sized gate built in the wall that separated their properties to let them through. They had two Plover biographies with them, one a soft-focus hagiography from the 1950s, authorized by the family, the other a hard-nosed psychoanalytic exposé from the early 1990s that anatomized Plover's complex and problematic sexuality, as symbolically dramatized in the various Fillory novels. They stuck to that one. It had better geography. They knew that the Chatwin house was on one Derby Lane, which helped, although the Cornish were even less interested in signage than the Venetians. Fortunately, Poppy turned out to be excellent at this kind of cross-country dead-reckoning navigation. At first, they thought she must be using some kind of advanced geographical magic, until Josh noticed that she had an iPhone in her lap.
"Yeah, but I used magic to jailbreak it," she said.
It was late afternoon, and they'd traversed what seemed like several hundred verdant and watership-down-esque, but stubbornly unmarked and unidentifiable rural byways, and the light was turning bluish before they settled on a Target property, which sat on a narrow lane that wasn't definitely not called Derby, and as near as they could tell, pretty much had to back onto Plover's enormous estate. There was no wall or gate, just a gravel track curving back through the late summer trees. A square stone post next to it supported a no trespassing sign. They couldn't see the house from here. Quietly, Julia read out the relevant passage from The World in the Walls. "The house was very grand, 3 stories tall, with a facade made of brick and stone and enormous windows and endless numbers of fireplaces and window seats and curving back stairs and other advantages which their London house distinctly lacked. Among those advantages were the sprawling grounds around the house, which included long straight alleys and white gravel paths and dark green pools of grass." There was a time when Quentin could probably have said it along with her from memory. Quentin sat in the car and stared across the road. He couldn't see much evidence of anything as nice as that. The place didn't exactly scream, "Portal to another world," either. He tried to imagine the Chatwins arriving here for the first time, the 5 of them crammed into the back seat of some sputtering black proto-automobile, more carriage than car, and with a fair amount of locomotive DNA in it as well, their luggage tied to the boot with twine and Victorian leather strappage. They would have been funereally silent, resigned to exile from London, the youngest, 5-year-old Jane, the future watcherwoman, reclining on her older sister's lap as on a chaise longue, lost in a fog of longing for her parents, who were respectively fighting World War I and raving in a posh rest home. Martin, who would grow up to become a monster, who would kill Alice, keeping his composure for the sake of the youngsters, his soft boy's jaw set in grim pre-adolescent determination. They'd been so young and innocent and hopeful, and they'd found something more wonderful than they could ever have hoped for, and it had destroyed them. "What do you think?" he said. "Julia, this is the place." "All right, I'm going to go in. Look around."
"Oh, come," Poppy said.
"No," Quentin said. "I want to go alone." To his surprise, it worked. She stayed put. Becoming invisible was a simple idea in theory, but in practice it was a lot harder than you'd think. It had been done, but it took years of meticulous self-erasure, and once accomplished, it was practically impossible to undo.
Apart from anything else, you could never be sure you'd reinstated your visible self completely accurately. You came out looking like a portrait of yourself. The best workaround Quentin knew was more like an animal's protective coloring. If you were standing in front of some leaves, you looked drab and leafy. If you weren't moving or jumping around, an observer's eye tended to skate over you. Usually, if the light wasn't too good. The car door chunked shut in the stillness. He felt the other's eyes on his back as he crossed the road. There was something on top of the stone post. Buttons. They were scattered in the grass around it, too. Big ones, small ones, pearly ones, tortoise shells. It must be a fan ritual. You come by, you leave a button, the way people left joints on Jim Morrison's grave. Still, he stopped and touched each of them, one by one, just to make sure none of them were genuine. The camouflage spell was unbelievably crude. He picked up a big leathery oak leaf, snapped off a shingle of bark from a tree, plucked a blade of the scanty grass, and collected a granite pebble from the edge of the road. He whispered a rhyming chant in French over them, spat on them, and the glamorous life of the modern sorcerer stuffed them in his pocket. Further up and further in, he stayed off the gravel driveway and picked his way through the trees for 5 minutes until there were no more, and then he was looking at Aunt Maud Chatwin's house. It was like he was looking back through time. The unpromising driveway had been a feint, a hustle. It really was a grand house. It probably would have qualified as magnificent if they hadn't just come from Plover's house. As Quentin got closer, the gravel track pulled itself together and became a proper driveway, which clove in two and formed a circle, with a modest but still entirely effective fountain at the center. Three rows of tall windows adorned the front, and the gray slate roof was a beautiful profusion of chimneys and gables. Quentin hadn't known what to expect. A ruin, maybe, or some appalling new modernist facade. But the Chatwin house was perfectly appointed and restored, and the lawns looked like they'd been trimmed that morning. It was everything Quentin had hoped for, except for one thing. It wasn't empty. That well-maintained lawn was littered with cars. They were nice cars that made the rental Jag look pokey by comparison. Yellow light spilled out of the lower floors and out into the mellowing dusk, chased by some nicely judged, not over-amplified, early rolling stones. Whoever's private hands the house was in, they were having a party. Quentin stood there, on the outside, looking in, as a little convocation of evening gnats began to gather over his head. It seemed sacrilegious. He wanted to barge in and order everybody out, like Jesus ridding the temple of moneylenders. This was ground zero for the primal fantasy of the 20th century, the place where earth and fillery had first kissed, like two cosmic billiard balls. Over the chatter, a roar went up, and a woman shrieked and then laughed uncontrollably. But looking on the bright side, it was a tactical windfall. It was a big enough party that they could mingle in, the girls especially. They wouldn't sneak in at all. They would walk in the front door, brazen it out. Then, when any suspicions had been allayed, they would slip upstairs and see what they could see. He walked back to the car to get the others. They found a spot for the car on the lawn. They weren't the least plausible bunch of partygoers imaginable. Quentin had invested in some nice clothes in Venice, charged to Josh's bottomless credit card. If anybody asks, just say John brought you.
Good one.
Dude, are you gonna... Josh gestured at Quentin's appearance.
Oh, right. Probably better not to show up looking like a pile of mulch. He killed the camouflage spell. Crossing the threshold, Quentin closed his eyes for just a moment. He thought of little Jane Chatwin, still alive and at large somewhere. Maybe she would be at the party, too. Josh made straight for the bar.
Dude, Quentin hissed, stay on mission.
We're in deep cover. I'm getting into character.
For all that it was a party at Maud Chatwin's house,
It was also just a party like any other party. There were pretty people and unpretty people, drunk people and undrunk people, people who didn't care what anybody thought about them, and people standing in corners afraid to open their mouths lest somebody look directly at them.